Thank you, Karen. I actually want to doubly thank you. I gave a shiur recently, and as they began the shiur, they announced to please turn off their cell phones, which all of the students dutifully did. And right in the middle, my cell phone rang. So it's all, you can't hear. Okay. So anyway, you didn't miss much. I really want to thank you, all of you who've come this morning. I've spoken here in the past and always get a great, tremendous enjoyment and chizuk from seeing people come out on a Sunday morning. My wife spoke here about a month ago and she had the same reflections as well. And it's a beautiful statement to our broader community of the dedication towards Torah, dedication towards self-improvement and growth, and that should only continue for many years to come. And a special thank you to Karen and the entire YU staff for putting these programs together. There's a statement in the Gemara that probably goes down as one of the most dreaded statements in all of Chazal. It's a statement that appears in the Gemara, I believe, in four different places. And that statement is, Shloshim Yom Kodem L'Chag, 30 days before the holiday. Of course, the holiday in question is Pesach. Sholim V'Dorshin Binyani HaChag. So that's already, you have to start asking questions, you start asking halachos, you start preparing oneself for Pesach. Unfortunately, where we live in Muncie, those preparations begin, you know, months in advance, which of course creates great anxiety to go to the supermarket in early February and see they're putting out the Pesach products already. But the reality is that as Shushan Purim a couple of days ago is sort of upon us or was upon us, so all of a sudden a person has the consciousness that, you know, 30 days from now Pesach begins, and there's a little bit of perhaps a knot in one stomach if you're staying at home and all the preparations involved. And perhaps as a result of that, the sense of opportunity of the Chag, the sense of excitement, sense of enthusiasm towards the Chag, perhaps is not always what it could be as a result. So what I did this year is I tried to place myself back to a different era of Pesach observance, and to see the Mesiris Nefesh, a Pesach observance in years past, going back really thousands of years, but in difficult times, in times of the Crusades, in times of the Muranos, and especially 70 years ago, in the times, of course, during the Shoah, and to see in many cases the passion, the seriousness, the intensity of halachic observance, even under the most difficult circumstances, and some degree that gives me a little bit of a sense of embrace of Hilchos Pesach instead of a sort of a running from Hilchos Pesach. And to a large degree also, I was moved by an article that I'm sure many of you saw in the New York Times probably about 6 weeks ago about the 70th year commemoration, or I don't know what the right word is, reunion of Auschwitz survivors, and how they gathered again in Auschwitz. And the article pointed out this will probably be the last gathering, the last reunion of its kind. It doesn't happen every year, and by the next few years already, you know, how many survivors will be left? And I was just very, I was overwhelmed by that thought, that there is a generation of people who went through those experiences, who will really not be that meaningful voice for me, for our children, for future generations, and reflections on their Mesiris Nefesh certainly is always appropriate, especially as the years and the decades move on. Now, it's fair to say, to be honest, that not every observant Jew, not every Jew, of course, asks the types of questions that I'm going to raise this morning. For every person who asked the Shaila, for every person that tried to observe Halacha, there are probably many more who didn't. You go through some of the stories of the worst ghetto, the Kovna ghetto, descriptions of people, you know, sitting there, people who are the most religious, the most observant, a year or 2 years before, sitting there like in public with three loaves of bread, saying, "This is what God situation that God put me through, and I'm going to do what I have to do to survive. I'm sure there were probably just as many people, if not more people, in that approach. But the sheer magnitude of individuals who clung to halachic observance is something which is noteworthy. I want to begin by sharing a shaila that was asked by one of the giants in Auschwitz, Zvi Hirsch Meisels, who ended up moving to the States. I don't know if anybody here is from Chicago. He became a rav in Chicago, and he wrote a sefer called Mekadshei Hashem. I want to go through, before some of the Pesach shailas that were asked, some of the general shailas that were posed either in ghettos or in the concentration camps. I'm not sure if everyone has seen these shailas before. Even if you have, they're certainly worth repeating. Zvi Hirsch Meisels, in his sefer Mekadshei Hashem, so he recounts something that happened in Auschwitz in 1944. An unbelievable shaila, an unbelievable circumstance for the person to be in and for Meisels to be in. And the question that was posed was the following. The word went out that 1,800 young men, young teenagers, would be gathered in the main courtyard, and they took out a measuring stick, a meter stick, and whoever was at the bar, if not higher, so that they would be saved for the moment at least. They would stay and they would have to work. Anybody who was too young or too short, anybody who did not measure to the measuring stick, so they were to be placed and guarded by the kapos, and then the next day, the next couple of days, they were to be sent off to be killed. 1,800 men were gathered, 400 of the young men measured to the meter stick, and 1,400 young men were, again, put in a certain bunk or a certain barrack to be guarded by the kapos awaiting their death. And people were coming to the kapos offering, of course, whatever they had. I have my grandmother's watch, I have a gold tooth, I have this, I have a little money saved up. You know, what can I do to somehow bribe you? What can I do to somehow remove my child from that imminent death? So one man approached the capo offering a bribe. And the capo said, okay, I'll accept that bribe and you can have your child. But the Nazis had a very firm count of 1,400 men, and they're going to count tomorrow. And if you remove your child from the barrack, then I will have to take another child and replace your child with a different kid. A man came to Zvi Hirsch Meisels on the spot, and he said, I'm asking you a shaila halacha l'maisa. Am I allowed to exchange my child for another child? Imagine even asking such a question. I mean, can you imagine even the depths of faith and commitment and, you know, just, I don't know the right word, you can ask such a question. It's worth pointing out that halacha in its best form is something that elevates a person, something that gives dignity to the person, discipline. And when people felt that their lives had just been torn asunder, for many people, the ability to connect to the halachic system and have some type of meaning and structure and form and seder in their life became even more important. So Zvi Hirsch Meisels tells the father, I'm going to pretend you didn't even ask me this question. He said, this is not a question I can paskin in the middle of Auschwitz. I'm not prepared to tell you to take your son and give up the other child. I'm not prepared to tell you to have your son killed. He said, I don't want to deal with the shaila. Whatever you do, I trust your instincts, your impulse, and I don't even pretend you didn't ask me the question in the first place. The man persisted. He said, I cannot engage in such a matter, dini nefasha, without asking shaila. I said, I'm asking you as the Rav here in Auschwitz what I should do. I go, Zvi Hirsch Meisels, I cannot paskin on the shaila. So the man said, if you didn't give me a psak, so I'm just going to assume the status quo. I can't take my child out and endanger another child. And if my child or my family goes to their death, I'll feel that I did so. I'll be halacha, making a kiddush Hashem. And kachava, he did not remove his child. Those were the shailas that were asked. Later, when Ritzvi Hirsch told over this incident from the Holocaust, people asked him, why didn't you paskin? What was sort of the issues involved? So what he said, just out of, the halachic issues, was that we know, and this is even quoted in your first source, the Ramah on the bottom, we say that a person, if their life is in danger, so they can save themselves by placing somebody else in that danger. But the Taz points out, and so the Sma points out in source number two, that's only if the danger is not right in front of you. I mean, if you're about to be killed, I can't say I'll take someone else. Only if there's a case, like there's a possibility down the road, so I'll exchange myself for someone else, and then who knows what's going to happen in a day from now, or a week from now, or 2 weeks from now. This was an imminent danger. This was something that was going to happen that day. And therefore, based on that logic of this mom, this is what a Tzvi Hirsch reasoned, he said a person cannot take themselves out of danger to put someone else in if that danger is immediate. But the only shaila that he had, well, there's a shach in Choshen Mishvat, and the shach says that whenever a person themselves is the one in danger, I can do whatever it takes, chayecha kodem, to save oneself, the famous Gemara of the famous question of the one canteen in the desert that every, you know, seminar, every Shabbaton has dealt with this issue, one canteen and who should get it. So chayecha kodem, I can always save myself. And the shaila that he had was, is a person's child or a person's wife like himself? If your child is like yourself, you can do whatever it takes to save yourself, even if it means at that moment someone else's life is going to be at risk. But if it's not, so then you have no right to put someone else in place of your child in that case. These are sort of the cheshbonos based on halacha, and he simply felt that he wasn't able to pass in that shaila in Auschwitz in 1944. Those are the types of issues. I want to mention three or four other similar questions that were posed. And some of the discussion that was that came afterwards. Some of these shailas were posed on the spot in Auschwitz, in Bergen-Belsen, and other places. And some of these shailas were posed afterwards, people trying to deal with their conscience of whether or not they did the right thing, whether or not they acted properly. I'll give you an example of a type of shaila that was asked after the war. By the way, just before we continue, I'm sure many people are aware that the major works on this topic is a set of tshuvos called Shalas of Tshuvos Mimamakim that was written by Rav Ephraim Oshri. Rav Ephraim Oshri was the Rav, or one of the Rabbanim in Kovno. The Rav of Kovno was a Dvar Vram, Rav Avram Shapiro, and he was the Rebbe of Ephraim Oshri. Ephraim Oshri was the Rav in Kovno, in the Kovno Gel, and there's Svarim Asvarim, there's four volumes of Svarim posed to him. He hid the Svarim in Kovno at the end of the war, and he came back later to retrieve them. He and his wife went on to Rome to found a yeshiva and a home for orphan kids from the war. Later he came to the States, and he was the Rav until his death in 2003 in the Beis Medrash HaGadol down on the Lower East Side. So much of these shailas, or the tshuvos, really revolve around questions asked to Ephraim Oshri. This was a question that I'm going to mention now that was posed. Right, exactly, in the Bronx as well. Thank you. This was a question posed not to Ephraim Oshri, but afterwards to Rav Yaakov Breisch, Nechelkos Yaakov. And it's a question that really was posed over and over again, but I'll also mention sort of an example of it, and namely that's the following. When the Nazis started leaving Auschwitz, they wanted to, I guess, get ahead of the Americans, so to speak, and they went on a rapid march out of Auschwitz, and people, of course, were just in the worst physical condition. And they allowed people to stop every, whatever the period of time was, to sit for a second. Two brothers were marching together, and they would take turns. You sleep, and I'll wake you up in 2 minutes, and the next break, I'll sleep, you wake me up in 2 minutes. They were so exhausted that they both fell asleep. And when either the whistle or whatever it was that was supposed to wake people up, one of the brothers woke up. He was in such like a state. You know, sometimes you wake up and you don't really know where you are. He came running back into line and they started marching off. And he looked back and he saw that his brother was still asleep 100 meters, 100 yards back. So at the very moment, he's thinking to himself, if I run back to get my brother, he said, I'll definitely be killed. He'll probably get killed. Or should I just try to save my life and move forward? And kachava, he moved forward. He saved his life. He survived the war. And the brother was killed. So the shiloh was posed. And can you imagine a person like living their life with that on their head? You know, thinking that there might have been a chance to save my brother. And like to go through life sort of with the weight of that shiloh. So he came to the Chelkas Yaakov, posing that question, I guess as a reflection of a rabbi of a shul myself, I guess sort of the difficult circumstance that someone like the Chelkas Yaakov found himself in. You know, here's somebody who's coming to him in the worst of sort of a psychological trauma. You know, you want to be very careful what you answer a person, you want to be very careful how you want to handle a shiloh like that. So this issue of risking your life to save another person actually is a very, very famous shaila for many reasons. And the question is, obviously I don't have to have myself killed to save somebody else. That's not the halacha. Question is, do I have to risk my life? If it's only a risk, a suffix nefashos, do I have to place myself in that position to save you? In other words, I can save you, but I'm risking my life along the same lines as well. And this seems to be, although even this is a machlokas between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, and this is discussed at length by the Acharonim, where the Bavli seems to assume there's no obligation to place yourself in risk to save somebody else, and the Yerushalmi says, or seems to assume, that there is an obligation, that if it's only a suffix in your life and you can save somebody else, you have to place yourself the suffix nefashos to save another person. Does anybody know parenthetically why this issue sort of continues to be significant to this day? I mean, even beyond the parameters of the specific shaila of saving yourself to save somebody else in wartime scenarios. But many of the issues about kidney donations and organ donations that the post can discuss revolve around this issue of, if I can save somebody else, do I have to place myself the suffix nefashos to save somebody else or not? And all of the tshuvos about organ donation revolves around this question. Now we paskin like the Bavli who says you don't have to risk your life to save somebody else. And that's what the Chelkas Yaakov told this person. He said, as hard as it is to wrap your hands around it, you did the right thing. You should not have risked your life to save somebody else. But as a parenthetic note, I just want to bring your attention to the Aruch HaShulchan, source number 4. The Aruch HaShulchan says, by the way, this is echoed by the Nitziv as well in the Tshuva, HaPoskim Hiviu B'Shem Yerushalmi, D'chayiv Adam L'Hachnis Es Atzmo L'Safik Sakana, K'dei L'Hatzl Chaveiro, that according to Yerushalmi, you do have to place yourself in that situation. But the Rishonim do not bring down this Yerushalmi. In the Bavli, according to the Bavli, you don't have to place yourself in that situation. There's no set rules, there are no set guidelines, every situation is different. A person who's, I guess, almost too concerned about his own life and doesn't want to risk his own life to save somebody else, like to be too, I guess, only self-concerned to some degree or just worried about yourself, that's not good. This is the Aruch HaShulchan. Ubezen nomar v'shamar enu v'yesh l'okim sezel sheshamar chosa v'chol mekai nefesh m'Yisrael Kulkim Olam Malay, the Anyur Day, etc., etc. So Aruch HaShulchan says, even though we paskin, you don't have to place yourself in the fashos, you shouldn't be so machmir in that halacha. You know, that if you put yourself in that situation, then you can sort of feel, kol mekayim nefesh achas miyisrael, ki elokim malam olay, that you saved an entire world. And the Nitziv has a lashon that says that to put yourself, the suffix sakana, is even like a midas chasidus. You know, we don't pass in that way. We see that Haronim said, you know what? If you feel you have to give up your life to save somebody else, do so. And again, these are some of the shaivas that were posed. There was an amazing shaila that was posed by some of the gedolim of the Warsaw Ghetto. Anybody know who some of the giants of the Warsaw Ghetto were? So people know from the Hasidic community, the Eish Kodesh, the Yosetzner Rebbe, who we'll discuss a little later, and probably from the more Litvish community, where Menachem Zemba was one of the giants of the Warsaw Ghetto, one of the elder rabbanim of the Warsaw Ghetto. There are just unbelievable stories about Menachem Zemba and the Warsaw Ghetto. They asked Menachem Zemba, which really goes to this issue as well. It was Erev Pesach in 1943. I don't know if anybody here can trace there or comes from Warsaw originally. And the fighters in the ghetto, they said, you know, if we fight, we're almost certain of losing our life. And that, of course, was the case. And if we don't fight, so then perhaps there's a chance of being saved. He says, should we fight but die with a certain spirit? Should we fight but sort of go to our graves making a statement of the valor and the passion of Israel? Or should we take the chance of just, I guess, succumbing and giving in? And Menachem Zemba, and that was the question they posed from Menachem Zemba. And he said, you know what? The world should know about the spirit of Klal Yisrael. And even if it means people have to give their life, you know, it's worth that fight to inspire and to be Mekadeshim Shemayim. There was an opportunity for the three last Rabbanim of the Warsaw Ghetto, including Menachem Shapiro, was Rav Stockheimer, Rav Nachum Zemba, excuse me, and Rav David Shapiro, that, I don't know all the details, the Catholic Church had somehow created a scenario where these three rabbis would be let go, or they could at least be hidden until the end of the war. And the shaila was posed by these three rabbanim, if we stay here, we're going to give up our lives. Is it worth giving up our lives just to give chizik to the people who are still here in the ghetto? We can't help them, we can't save them. Staying here is not going to change anything, but just being here to be a presence, to be mechazik, the people here. And again, that was the psak they had for themselves. Even though we know we're giving up our lives, it's worth doing so to be mechazik, the people who are here in the ghetto. I want to tell you one last, really just unbelievable tshuva, unbelievable question that was posed, and then we'll move on to the section about Pesach. The question was asked to Rav Ephraim Oshry in the Kovno ghetto, as they began to liquidate the ghetto, somebody came to Rabbi Moshri and said, from the reports I've received, when the Nazis come into the ghetto, they don't just take people, they don't just kill people, but they abuse the women in the most personal way, they abuse the children in front of the husbands. And he said, there's no way that I could bear to watch my wife being violated, my children being tortured. He said, am I allowed to take my own life, mi'avir atzma v'das, in circumstances such as that? And that was the question posed to Ephraim Moshri. Again, imagine even having to ask that question. Imagine having to answer that question. So very briefly, just to mention some of the issues, and he wrote a very, very lengthy tshuva about this topic, where obviously the conclusion was that these are very, very unusual circumstances, that under normal circumstances, of course, chas v'shalom, a person can never think about taking their life. But some of the cheshbonos that he used were the following. So we know that Shaul HaMelech supposedly took his life. There's obviously a dispute even in the Nevi'im itself as far as what happened. The question is, why was that? What was sort of the justification for Shaul HaMelech taking his own life? So before we do that, let's take maybe a look in the source number 6 In the very famous Gemara in Avodah Zarah and Daf Yuches Min Aleph, the Gemara that I'm sure everyone here is familiar with, the Gemara says, talking about Rav Chanan ben Tragion, if you go to the third page, so it says the top line, V'chocho kol gedoli romin l'kavro v'espiduhu ha'hesped gadol, because our son, Matzuhu Rabbi Chanina ben Tragion, Shaya Yoshe v'osek b'Torah, this is of course during the time around the Rekochim Rebellion, so Rabbi Chanina ben Tragion was learning Torah, U'mako kehilos b'rabbin, v'sefer Torah munach lo b'cheikom, so the Romans took him, heviyu v'karchu b'sefer Torah, they wrapped him in the Sefer Torah, v'kifu b'chavbilez muros, they lit him on fire. They took wet cloths to put him by his heart so that he would die slower. So Amar Labito, again, the famous Gemara, Abba, Erecha Bekach, how can we see you in such a state? So Amar La, Yomali Ani Nisrafti Levadi Hayahadavar Kashali. This isn't just for myself. Achshav Shani Nisraf Sefer Torah Yimi, Mishim Evakesh Elbona Shal Sefer Torah, Hu Yivakesh Elboni. In other words, if it's just me, I wouldn't care. But seeing that it's a Sefer Torah also, if somebody can step forward. So Amar La Tamidav Rabbi Mata Roe, what do you see? So Amar Lahen, Gilyon Nisrafin Veosios Porchos. I see the letters flying up to Shemayim. So Avata Patach Picha Vatichnas Bachaesh. In other words, like, open your mouth and the fire will enter your mouth. Somer lahen, mutav sheyitlenda mi shenosna, v'yal yechavahu bi'atzmo. You know what? I don't want to take my own life even under these circumstances. If a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants to have me killed, he'll have me killed. If somebody else wants to kill me, they'll kill me. But I don't feel that I can take my life under those circumstances. And this Gemara, among many others, informs the position about how we feel, of course, about taking one's own life. Now that being said, with the paradigm of Shaul HaMelech, Shaul HaMelech did so, and many people assume that he did so perhaps because he wanted to avoid torture, he did so because Mavir al-Das, perhaps he was going to somehow give up his religion according to some Rishonim. Take a look at this amazing Ritva in light of that story by Shaul. So how do we mean by Hagadah Rabbi Chanina ben Tragion, mutav yitlena mishenosna v'lo echvo bi'atzmi. I can't take my own life. Someone else can kill me instead. So kasa b'goyoni hatosvos. And by the way, just keep in mind, the Ritva lived where? Anybody know the Ritva lived in Spain? But the Bali Tosvos, as we'll see in a second, of course, were not just commenting in a theoretical way about these cases, but Rabbeinu Tam and others, they were living through the Crusades, where these were often very, very practical shailas. So, Kosev Goyoni HaTosvo, Shehaya Omer Rabbeinu Tam, the Hechar Shemizyare, Shelo Yakrithuhu Le'avor Adas, that maybe he might be converted, he might be forced to convert, he's not going to be able to maintain his Jewish identity. So, he's allowed, La'avor Adas, Mutter Lachvo Biatzmo. So, under those circumstances, if you feel that, again, people are coming in, they're going to try to forcibly convert you, and you may do so, so therefore you would be allowed to give up your life under those circumstances, according to Rabbeinu Tam. Okay? And that's the shita of the Ritva, that even though we have a policy, as seen by that Gemara in Avodah Zarah, you can never take your life, the Ritva says it's really not true. If you're nervous about, again, giving up and converting, forcibly converting, so a person therefore would be allowed to convert. Now there's an amazing tshuva that I photocopied, number 8, by the Besamim Rosh. You can give an entire shir. I see that Mrs. Rapp is here, so next time maybe Rabbi Rapp comes, he can give an entire shir. He's far more scholarly than I am, just about even the Svarim Besamim Rosh. You know, Besamim Rosh, you see the name in there, it sounds like it's the Rosh. So some people say these were tshuvos actually of the Rosh, and some people say, no, it's really not the Rosh at all, it was just like a counterfeit, it wasn't him, somebody wrote it and put his name. There's tremendous intrigue about who wrote these tshuvos of the Besamim Rosh. Sometimes as a side note, to sort of take like a breather from the heaviness of this material, sometimes the intrigue of who wrote the Sefer is actually just as fascinating as the Sefer itself. You know, for so many years, everyone assumed that the Zohar was written by Shimon Bar Yochai, And Moshe de Leon, when he published the Zohar, said, yeah, this was written by Shimon bar Yochai, but I found the manuscript, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later. And then after he died, his wife said, no, he wrote it, you know, and he lied about the fact that it was Shimon bar Yochai. It's always the wife who's, you know, sort of like coming in to say what has to be said. He said, but my husband, Moshe de Leon, said that if he wrote the Zohar, you know, who's Moshe de Leon? Who's going to read a Sefer written by Moshe de Leon? So he said, no, this is written by Shimon bar Yochai and became famous. But his wife said, my husband wrote it. It wasn't Shimon bar Yochai. So there's always like intrigue, and with some Rosh a little bit, sort of like similar stories about these Sfarim as well. Now, he has an unbelievable tshuva, which I imagine that if you've never seen the tshuva, you would never believe what he said. It's very difficult to read. It's teeny, and the letters are not great, but just even to get a basic sense. So take a look at the top in number 8. Asher shaltani bi'echad chaser lahem lachem. The person was impoverished. He didn't have food. I don't even know these words. V'chashiv sheis, whatever the word is. Shehalach bifnei sheini v'amar. So afati chayoy. In other words, he wants to take his life because of his impoverished conditions of the avod atzmo, and he took his life because of just again poverty and sa'ar and yisurin. This is imrashai krovav lehistavel. Would this be a case where the relatives are allowed to mourn? The relatives can say kaddish, the typical Jewish burial, etc. Kave in the pasuk harambam zav hilchos avel, etc. They ain't misavlin olav. That of course we bring down the halacha, the Rambam, based on the Mishnah and Tzmachos, brought down the Shulchan Aruch, that you're not misavel for a person who is ma'avid atzmo l'das. Now, by the way, unfortunately, this is a topic that is not just theoretical. You know, bismaneinu, you'll never ever see a posek who says that if a person did take their life, we don't mourn for them. Because the assumption is that every person took their life, obviously was suffering from tremendous depression or other mental illness, and therefore they don't have a status as someone who did so willingly. So this, even though it's a very, unfortunately, a relatively common issue, so it's not something that this halacha of the Rambam is never enforced. So if you go through the tshuva of the Sfarim Rosh, maybe even skipping down a few lines, so amnam beikar hanido. We're now at the beginning of the fourth line. Chalila ladon es ha'ish hazel ra'a. We can't judge this person who was impoverished and starving l'ra'a. We can't judge him negatively. Ukvar amru b'medrash al pasuk achas dimchem l'nafto seichem ad rosh. That pasuk in Parshas Noach that says that you cannot take your life. So yachol kishol ben yakish ben kish. Does that mean that Shaul also did something wrong? Tamalomar ach, meaning that what Shaul did was okay, right? And then if you continue, just skipping down another line, v'lo tomar dafka shishishchuhu bebezuyim gedolim hiskalis b'Yisrael. It's not only this case of Shaul that did so that the plishtim would not come and they would not try to sort of denigrate the Jews, and that's why he took his own life. Anybody who takes their life because of riboy tzarosav, da'agos v'yusurin o onigamor, for worries or poverty, ein kan mechush. We're not concerned. Meaning this is not where the halacha of mi'avid atzmo l'das comes in. This is not the situation where we say you don't sit shiva for that person. The person really had riboy tsaros, riboy dagos. Person was starving and they took their life. We say that's understandable, and therefore you would still sit shiva for that person. So based on that, Rabbi Ephraim Oshri said, even though I would never want to pass on like this normally, and even though this can only be, I guess, done or followed through by a person who is real Yorei Shemayim, in this sort of specific situation, if you feel that you're in such tsa'ar, that you cannot watch this happen to your wife and children, so then perhaps there's a heter to take your life. And that was a tshuva halacha maisa which was posed to Rabbi Ephraim Oshri. I should make a side note. He commented later that in all Kovna ghetto, only 3 people had taken their life, and that was true by the Warsaw Ghetto as well. And there's a certain amount of discussion in the diaries of the Warsaw Ghetto of almost surprise that more people didn't take their life. That it was almost like we're only speaking about a handful of cases, and that in and of itself is a certain inspiration of the spirit of man. I want to just, I know we're running so late on time, but it's even just to bring to your attention a very famous, you sort of can't do this topic without seeing this Das HaKanim. Das HaKanim is really the parish of the Baalei Tosvos on Chumash, the source number 9. And at the beginning of the Das HaKanim, he brings down the position of the Ritva and Rabbeinu Tam. Namely, if you're afraid that, during the Crusades, you're going to be forcibly converted to Christianity, and you're not going to be able to stand that, you're allowed to take your life. So another sheet is brought down by the Baalei Tosvos. This is the right place to begin. So he says that other people disagree. See, V'yesha Osrin, right in the middle of the paragraph. V'yesha Osrin, U'mefarshim kein yochol kechananya v'chaverov shekvar nimsu l'misa tamalomar ach, even Chananya Mishal v'Azariah cannot have taken their life. Aval enu yochol l'harogis atzmo, yochol kishol shemasar atzmo l'misa tamalomar ach, right? So perish she'enu yochol lachlo ba'atzmo klal. That ach, that pasuk means you can never do it, right? Even these circumstances, you can never take your life. V'shal shelo b'rishus chachamim asa. It's quite a line. The Shaul did something, right, not in keeping with the Das Chachamim. When Shaul took his life, don't think it was okay that he did so. It was not the Das Chachamim. Okay? So look at the next line. U'masa b'rav echad. Have you ever seen this before? U'masa b'rav echad, sheshamad harbe tinokos b'shas hashmad. What's the shas hashmad? Baalei Tosvos is speaking about. During the Crusades, there was one rabbi, shehishmit harbe tinokos, right? Basically, he killed the children. Why? Ki hayyore shem yaviruhum aldas. He was nervous that there's no way these kids would be able to not sort of stand up to the pressure of conversion, and said better that they have their lives taken than convert to Christianity and I guess be obdei avodah zarah. Okay, by a rabbi echadimo, right, and there was another rabbi with them. V'haya koesalav, he says, what are you doing? He said, you're going to have these children killed? He said, absolutely not. Right, v'karu rotzeach, he says that you're a killer for having these children killed, right? V'hu lo haya choshesh. And the first rabbi, he said, you know what? I'm not worried about it. V'amar osarav, the second rabbi said, im kedivre yehareg osarav, sorry, im kedivarai, if I'm right, yehareg osarav v'misa mishuna. Ultimately, you will have to die an unusual death for what you did to these kids. V'chein hayam. I don't want to translate these words. If you understand them, you understand them, but it's almost too gory to translate. Shetavsuhu akum. The crusaders came. Vayuposhtin oro. V'nosnin chol ben ha'or v'habasar. Right? V'yakarkach nisbak v'hagzera. And right afterwards, the crusades came to an end. V'imlo. Shochtu osan hatinokos hayunitzolin. If it wasn't for the fact that he'd taken the lives of these kids already, they would have been saved. So this sort of shita, this Baalei Tosvos, is like the opposite approach. He says, even if you're going to be converted to Christianity, he says, you should still do it. Don't take your life in advance. And he disagrees with the shita of Rabbeinu Tam. We only have about 12 minutes left. Anybody have any question of anything we did until now about sort of this first segment? Maybe there's one question. And, yeah. Absolutely, right. So Masada is sort of a very, Masada sort of poses a conundrum. I think most of us sort of grew up. I remember watching a movie back in the late 70s, so like a miniseries. I'm sure many of you remember it. And, you know, Masada was always glorified. We always speak with Masada people. You know, the reality is that it's not clear that what they did was correct. There might be justifications, maybe what they did was correct. But certainly, if the option is to be taken as an eved, as a slave to Rome, or give up your life, it's not clear that what they did in Masada was correct. But again, it's hard for us to judge looking back on history. But certainly, based on what many of you shown him say, as much valor as you look back to Masada with, it might not have been halachically justifiable. Okay. Now, with all that being said, I want to just go through and maybe even do so quickly, four or five of the real issues and shilas that were posed in the ghetto, that were posed in Auschwitz around Pesach time. And you can imagine, more than Rosh Hashanah, more than Yom Kippur, more than any other Chag, the feeling of Pesach approaching in the ghetto, right? Pesach approaching in the camps, you know, brought with it such emotion and such, you know, such a sort of a sense of the heaviness of the experience. People to sort of sit as they did, you know, speaking about, you know, now we're B'nai Chorin and whether we should do Haseva or not, whether we should be leaning, and the Shalom of Yishalayim and the entire history of the Jewish people. I mean, you can just sort of imagine that for millions of people, many of our own grandparents, uncles, and aunts, what it must have been like sort of those days of Pesach, of just sort of going through those experiences. With that, to mention maybe four or five of the halachic issues, and some of them I have photocopied here. If you look on the page number four, the first question that was posed was an issue of, actually before we get to number 10, so we don't have photocopied, you know, one of the, again, as a rabbi of, I guess, a young Israel, a modern Orthodox shul, you know, there's certain halachos that are sort of stuck in the craw of like Balabatin. You know, one issue, Yontav Sheni Shogalius, keeping 2 days of Yontav in Israel. There's certain things that, like, you know, half the shul always, you know, raises a certain stink about. And one of those areas is kitnios. You know, kitnios, what are we still doing? Machben and kitnios nowadays. The whole reason for it doesn't apply anymore. And then all the conundrum about quinoa. I mean, just, you know, kinyos is like the, it's like a yearly source of consternation, by often people in our community. And of course, the Chassam Sofer said that seeing that kinyos was a law taken upon ourselves by the Ashkenazi community, so we would need a greater basis. We need a greater minyan to matir that halachas, even though it doesn't apply anymore. So it was a shiloh that was posed to some of the poskim in Auschwitz, that the only food they had were the black beans that were given to them by the Nazis. And the shiloh was asked, are we allowed to eat kidneys this Pesach? Imagine even like asking such a shiloh when people are down to 60, 70 pounds. And in fact, people were so concerned about the Minhag Ashkenaz that the Piyuset of the Rebbe, the Eish Kodesh, he convened a Beis Din in the Warsaw Ghetto to go ahead and be matir, do the Kataris Nadarim on kidneys. He says this is an old Ashkenazi tradition. People should sort of still feel that in some way halacha and law is still relevant. And he was matir neder that the Ashkenazi community in the Warsaw Ghetto can eat kidneys. And that's actually tshuva that you'll find in the Shalash Tshuvas Mimamakim as well. There's another question posed, and sort of skipping down, we'll go back to the top afterwards. The question which is posed in number 13 of in the Kovna ghetto, you know, can you imagine the idea of getting dalad kosos, of getting yayin, of getting grape juice? I mean, just, you know, of course there was no opportunity for that. But we know that dalad kosos, even though it's only a halacha midrabanan, is something that is taken so seriously. We know the Mishnah of Psachim on Daf Tzadi Tes in the Beis, and the Rashbam discusses this, that even the Ani should sell their clothing for dalad kosos. Probably a halacha we don't have in other places, but dalad kosos is so significant. So they got together, a chabur of young men, together with Rav Oshri, trying to figure out what can a person drink for dalad kosos and be yotzei the mitzvah. And part of that tshuva revolves around the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah on the bottom of the page, number 13, right? So it says, ובמקומו שנוהגים לשתות משקה הנעשה מדבש שקורן, anybody know where this is? Mem ayin dalid? Mead, right? יוכל לקחת אותו משקה לארבע כוסות אם אין לו יין. If you have no wine, says the Maharil, so you can take mead. What's mead? Mead is chomer medina. So you can take chomer medina. What's chomer medina? You know, juice or a beer, things that have a certain significance in the land you're living in for dalad kosos. But the poskim don't talk about the issue of tea. So if Ephraim Oshri has a tshuva, the only drink they could find that wasn't water was like a very lightly sweetened tea. And he has entire tshuva about whether or not you could be yotzei dalad kosos with this sort of sweetened tea that is the only thing they could find in the ghetto. There's another tshuva, and this revolves around question of my source number 10 and source number 10. There were Jews one year who found, when they were on a work detail, they found some potato grinds. You know, when I saw the shuv originally, I thought about our house. I'm sure your house is the same way also, if you're children survivors or grandchildren survivors the way that I am. You know, you don't approach food the same way. You know, until the food's been in the fridge for 2 months and it's growing things out of it, you don't want to throw it out. But you think about in the average house, how much food is thrown out on a daily basis, on a weekly basis. Our kids have no sense about, about tashchis or what it means that to have to sort of go without. So this shuva discusses that they found on a work detail potato grinds somewhere in a garbage heap. And a number of the Jews got together and they realized that they could take the potato grinds with some flour they found and they could make matzah in the ghetto, they can make matzah even in the camps, by combining the potato grinds with the flour. Again, this is probably not the, $30 pound shmur matzah that we eat, but you can be yotzei matzah with the potato grinds and the flour. And we know that Gemara tells us, which is quoted in the top of source number 10, that the water from peiros, and this is a discussion in halacha in general, what status does the zeya, does the liquid of fruits and vegetables have, that liquid that's on the potato grinds is not machmis. It's not going to create chametz, and therefore it's fine. But the question that was raised, and the Shulchan Aruch continues to address this, is that they had to wash off the potato grinds, they were disgusting, and then the water from washing potato grinds and mixing with the flour creates chametz, and the shaila was posed, is this the type of matzah that we can use or not in the ghetto, in the concentration camps, or should we not use it because there's a chashash of chametz by doing so? And this again were the questions that were posed, and there's actually a back and forth of some of the poskim, both in the ghetto and even in Auschwitz, about the permissibility of this matzah made from potato grinds. And the Rav Dov Ber Shapiro, the Dvar of Ram in the Kovna ghetto, he sent out a tshuva in the ghetto saying, you probably should not do this. It's better to not have this matzah, better eat something else because of the fear of chametz. Unless you go ahead and don't use water, you just scrub the potato grinds by hand and you dry them off. If you're going to do that, it's fine. But this was the tshuva that was circulating through the Kovna ghetto about the matzah made with the potato grinds. One last fascinating, depressing shiloh that was posed to Rabbi Moshiri revolved around the following question. They used to give out bread for 2 weeks. Here, take your roll or your two rolls or three rolls, and that's going to be your bread for the next 2 weeks. I was thinking about the shuva yesterday. We had deli sandwiches at lunch, and the bread was a little bit, it wasn't exactly fresh, and we're moaning at the table, the bread's not fresh. Thinking about sort of this tshuva in light of our own sort of sensibilities. So you have the bread for the next 2 weeks. Now what happens if you're given bread 2 days before, a week before Pesach, and then, even if you don't eat it, that is going to violate the principle of chametz she'avar lav Pesach. Can they then use these rolls or the bread after Pesach because it was in your possession during Pesach? And there's a lengthy discussion, if you have a few moments, look yourself in number 12 of Mishnah Berurah, of why is it in the first place that we have the mechiras chametz? Namely, if I did bittul on the chametz, it's no longer mine, it's no longer chametz, so why then do I have to sell it? Why do you go to the rabbi to sell your chametz? And there are different reasons given, but one reason that's brought down, and you'll see the Mishnah Berurah quotes it, is for those people that really are not mevato their chametz. They don't sell their chametz, and they say, we sold it, or we negated it. Those people, they're always looking for a loophole. So we say it's not enough that it's in your possession and you're mevato it, but you have to sell it as well. So therefore, question is, but let's say it's a case where you can't sell it. Mechir is not an option. So can you rely just on bittul, or do we say that's chametz shavu lav Pesach as well? And that was the question that hundreds of people came to Rav Chaim Osher and said, is bittul enough to allow us to have the bread after Pesach? And most poskim said, absolutely, it's not a problem. Eat, and you have to eat. Rav Moshe also had a chiddush, namely the following. He said that the reality is you don't own anything. Let's say a man went to a woman with this piece of bread and says, I'm mekadesh you with this piece of bread. Is the woman married to him? Does it belong to him? The answer is no. The Nazis owned everything. Nothing belonged to you in the first place. And therefore, there was no ownership over the bread in the first place. But again, just the sensibilities of the concern for halacha, these questions are being asked. I want to just conclude with two thoughts. The first was that many people came to the Rabbanim in Bergen-Belsen. Karen, how much time do I have? Like 5 minutes? Okay, so actually before I say that, I just want to mention that in general there's a question of can a person give their life to fulfill a mitzvah? Obviously, to avoid killing a person, I give my life. To avoid a avodah zarah, to avoid gilui raos, I give my life. But let's say, to fulfill the mitzvah properly of matzah. We know that the Esh Kodesh, the Pisetzner Rebbe, other Rabbanim, the Warsaw Ghetto, they risk life and limb to go to a well to draw the mayim shalanu, so they can have the matzah in the way that is more mehudar, is more glorified. A person who says, I'm not going to eat chametz, and I may give my life for that, is that even something that is even sort of justifiable? Someone comes to you and says, I'm going to risk my life to not eat chametz. So the reality is that's a discussion in the poskim, but I will just bring your attention to a very, very famous Gemara in Masechta Sanhedrin, a Gemara that probably you're familiar with. Let's look at number 15. We know, of course, the big three averos. But Kiyata Rav Dimi, Amar Rav Yochanan, Lo Shanu Ela Shelo B'Shas Hashmad. When we say that you can only give your life for these three averos, that's only when it's not a time of persecution. If a B'Shas Hashmad, I feel a mitzvah kala yehareg b'al yavor. It's a Shas Hashmad, you know, there's a wider range of mitzvos and averos that you can give your life for. Kiyata Rav in Amar of Yochanan, Afil Shalom B'Shas Hashmad, even if it's not during the time of persecution, Lo Amru Ela Betzina. That's only if someone makes you violate a sin in private. Afil B'Far Hesia, in public, Afil Mitzvah Kalo Yehreg B'Al Yavor. You can give your life rather than violate an avera. So my mitzvah kala, to what extent do we say that? So I'm a rabbi bar Yitzchak, I'm a rav, I feel the shnuye arkasa de mesana. Everybody know what that is? To even change the way they would strap their shoes, and that might even be just like a according to Rashi in that Gemara, even just a minhag tzniyusa, a more like modest minhag, and they say, give up the modest way that you want to tie your shoes, something else. If it's a shas hashmad, so according to this opinion of the Gemara, a person give their life for that. Now obviously we're not like, you know, Al-Qaeda, you know, running to constantly give our life. We would almost never sort of adjudicate that a person should give their life, but there's a certain sort of sensibility of understanding that B'Shas HaShmad, sometimes there might be things and values and ideals even more significant than life. You know, how a person dies, how a person lives the last few days of their life, messages sent to their children, messages sent sort of throughout the swath of Jewish history. And what this Gemara is sort of highlighting is that sometimes life is not the highest value. Sometimes how a person dies and how they live, and again, the message sent to future generations, that sometimes perhaps takes precedence over life itself. And I think that's something that all of us understand intrinsically. I want to conclude just with two last thoughts that are not halachic. The first is, as I was saying before, the Rabbanim in Bergen-Belsen, they composed the tefillah. Right? Anybody here with a Hasidic background, so we know that you say like a yiratzon before the mitzvah chilas matzah. They wrote a tefillah of a yiratzon for all people up to yichametz. Yiratzon, it should be your will that you realize that we're not doing this out of any lack of sensitivity towards the mitzvos, that we're doing this only because of this time, but hopefully by next year already we'll be shalayim in matzah. And they wrote this, and they sent it throughout the barracks in Bergen-Belsen, and that's the way people spend Pesach night, eating and saying this yiratzon about future years. And to me, that's an unbelievable scene. I want to conclude with something that I saw in Mordechai Eliav's book, and I'll read the English version of it. So on Friday, March 2nd, we reached Mauthausen. In those last few difficult weeks that we spent in the concentration camp, some of us worked in the unloading of cars of grain for the warehouse. A number of times, Our small group succeeded in taking a little bit of wheat from the warehouse. The religious Jews among us gave up their bread rations in exchange for that wheat. In this fashion, they accumulated a small quantity of wheat for Pesach. They crushed the grains of wheat with a hammer into a kind of flour. This they baked into matzos, and so some tens of Jews were able in Mauthausen to conduct the two Sedarim for the two first nights of Pesach. Late at night, when the guards had left our block, several tables were set up in the washing room. We lit two candles. Each participant received one small matzah. One of us began reciting the Haggadah in a tremulous voice. The rest repeated it after him weeping. Their voices choked with sobs. Thus did a small group of Jews, in the shadow of death, conduct the two Sedarim in the madhouse and concentration camp. So it's brought to all of us that as we approach the coming weeks and the coming month, we do so, A, with an understanding of the opportunities, the ease in which observant Jews conduct their life is manenu in ways that perhaps have never, ever, in the history of the Jewish people, ever been seen before. But more importantly, that the spirit in which we approach the Hilchos Pesach, the experience of Pesach, is not one of Chas V'Shalom negativity, but is infused with the spirit of the generations and generations of people who have come before us, who saw, in many cases, halacha as an opportunity for meeting, halacha as an opportunity to ennoble and to elevate. And we should be blessed with that same spirit, infuse that same spirit, and express that same spirit of the course of our preparation and our celebration of the days of Pesach. Thank you, everyone, and enjoy the next year. Take care.